A friend of mine said, I've got to play you a piece recording. And I said, okay. And he put on the Rite of Spring. I think it was conducted by Pierre Monteux, who was a big champion of Stravinsky early on. And it just completely, I just couldn't believe what I was listening to. I'd never heard anything remotely like it.
This is Essential Tremors.
I'm Lee Gardner.
I'm Matt Byers. The idea behind this show is to have musicians and other creators talk about songs that shaped who they are. We're not looking for favorite songs, necessarily. We're also not looking for songs that they'd choose to take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. What we're looking for are songs that have significance to them. Songs that might have changed the course of their creative lives or their lives in general. Steve Reich, born in 1936 in New York City, is by many accounts the most important living composer in America, and the case will one day likely be made for the posthumous assignment of this accolade as well. Working primarily with repetitive patterns, some complex, some simple, all of them mesmerizing and ranging in instrumentation from hand claps to full orchestras, Reich's best work builds and interweaves in ways that, especially when listened to in a fully immersive manner, are utterly transcendent, like calculus equations that, over time, solve themselves. Even if you're not aware of him by name, his influence can be heard in vast swaths of the landscape of more cerebral strains of pop music of the last 50 years, and especially in the work of forward-looking musicians, ranging from Brian Eno to post-rock quintet Tortoise. However, if all this implies a coldly academic approach to music that can only be appreciated cerebrally, in fact, Reich's compositions are deeply emotional and vividly evocative, as evidenced by this piece, Duet for Two Solo Violins and String Orchestra, dedicated to and written for Yehudi Menuhin. The first song chosen by Reich as being formative for him was Igor Stravinsky's La Sacre du Printemps, or The Rite of Spring.
The Rite of Spring sort of really made me become a composer, to put it very, very simply. I was 14 in 1950. At that point in my life, I really hadn't heard any classical or notated music before 1750 or after Wagner. And I also hadn't heard any real jazz either. A friend of mine said, I've got to play you a piece recording. And I said, okay. And he put on the Rite of Spring. I think it was conducted by Pierre Monteux, who was a big champion of Stravinsky early on. And it just completely, I just couldn't believe what I was listening to. I'd never heard anything remotely like it. It seemed like the whole world around me sort of changed. And I just felt that it was the most most wonderful thing I'd ever encountered. As time passed, I began, you know, looking at the score and listening to other recordings and trying to hear Stravinsky conduct, which he still was doing. He passed away in 1971. This was, so there was a bit of time to go to concerts and hear him. What can I say? The rhythmic energy in that piece and in many other pieces, it just struck, I mean, I was studying percussion at the time, I am sort of naturally a drummer, and it spoke to me very, very directly and without question, and something totally new rhythmically. What was it? Well, a lot of it was what later I would understand is to be called changing meters, you know, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, et cetera. Little groups of twos and threes irregularly placed. Mm-hmm. And that is very prominent in the last part of the Rite of Spring, the Danse de Crowell. And I think that resurfaced, sort of unasked for, when I was composing Tehillim way in 1981. And I found myself, you know, reading the text of the Psalms in Hebrew, Hashem Mayim Masaparim Kavod Kiel, and a melody popped in my head. Hashem Mayim Masaparim Kavod Kiel. At the same time, this popped in my head. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1. I thought, you know, what is that? And then I thought, wait a minute, this is like, you know, Stravinsky, you know, unasked for, is like bubbling up from the lower strata in my memory. And it then persisted and became a real second basic rhythmic way of working for me, the first being a kind of all-purpose three, which is either, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 60s. So I owe a great deal to Stravinsky, and I still admire The Rite of Spring and many other pieces of his, and I guess that's about it.
What were you listening to before this? You it sounds like you were pretty familiar with the quote-unquote classical canon, at least as it was at that time.
Well, I was growing up in a middle-class household, and the recordings that were around and the music that I heard, Beethoven Fifth, Schubert Unfinished, Overture to the Meistersinger, the sort of middle-class favorites. The Beethoven stuck with me. Basically, I am not terribly moved by German or Central European music after Beethoven until we get up to Stravinsky and Bartok. And that sort of sets me apart from a lot of other people. I've also discovered shortly after Stravinsky, I mean weeks after, very shortly after, the Bach Brandenburg No. 5, which I've actually been modeling for a piece I just completed for Ensemble and Orchestra, which is a kind of blown-up version of Concerto Grosso, which is what the Brandenburg Concertos are. So the what became clear was that I'm more interested in classical music before 1750 and after 1900. And there's sort of this period in the middle where there's Beethoven and maybe a little bit of Haydn, and that's about it. So that's where I mostly learned from, medieval music and Stravinsky and Bartok on the other end.
You're not the first guest of ours to pick The Rite of Spring as a formative piece for them. But at the same time, I am wondering about your take on this. It seems like it becomes more and more difficult. As great as the piece is, and as I think undiluted as its power is, it doesn't sound so surprising and shocking maybe these days compared to what a lot of people are more generally exposed to and all the things that have come along since, including your music. Do you think that power to shock is still there somehow?
Power to shock is not what's interesting at all. It may be, passingly. I mean, I've experienced that myself. When Four Organs was done in 1973 at Carnegie Hall with me and Michael Tilson Thomas and members of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, it caused a riot. We repeated it with the San Francisco Symphony in 1996, and everybody applauded, hey, nice piece. The point is that The Rite of Spring is still a great piece to listen to. It's very, very enjoyable music. It's very, very absorbing music. There's a lot to, you know, emotionally respond to and to intellectually, you know, go over. And that's what makes a classic is a piece of news that stays news. Not shocking, but it's just, it preserves itself. The excellence of its materials and execution, just they last, apparently, you know, as long as we last.
The second song chosen by Reich as being essential to his development as an artist is a piece by 12th century French composer Paratin, Viderunt Omnes.
We don't really know what his name was. That was that's kind of a title. It might have been that his name was Pierre. I mean, he's sort of clouded in anonymity.
Right, and this was, late 13th century?
No. It's about 12th century. It's about
1100. I see.
Very early 12th century. This Perrotin work, which follows the work of Leonine, his predecessor, was done at the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, at the close of the 11th and 12th century. And it's referred to in music history terms as the organum. And what it is, basically, is taking the Gregorian chant. It's the music which follows immediately, you know, after Gregorian chant. It's the first step taken to elaborate on that. It's as if you were singing the chant in slow motion. So let's just say in the chant there was this phrase, Bariha. Well, okay, in Perrotin, or in Leonine for that matter, that little line, da-dee-da, I'm running out of breath, quick, you take over. It requires two tenors to sing how long it is, but it's not a drone. It goes on, in modern notation, maybe a page or two, da, da, and the second note of the melody comes in. Again, enormously augmented is the musical term for it, elongated. So this little phrase can take, you know, a couple of minutes of music, with the melody becoming the harmonic center for what? For, in Leonine 1, in Perrotin 2, 3, or 2 or 3 other voices. So you have, in Perrotin, the first four-part music we have in Western civilization, which has become kind of a standard. It's odd in Perrotin because there really is no bass. There's a tenor and three other tenors. And the music is very closely spaced in the middle register around the tenor. The voices cross over each other. And they are singing, da da dee da dee da 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 dee da da da. Basically, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. It's the first measured music as well. They're called the rhythmic modes derived from Perrotin and Leonine in that period. And so, for me personally, I was at Cornell University in the 50s, studying music and philosophy. And the music history course taught by Professor William Austin, fine musicologist who is no longer with us, and a great pianist, great organist, played this piece by this, you know, Perrotin guy, whoever that was. And I was just knocked out. I said, wow, that's great. So I went to the library, and there's this book of the masterpieces of the music before 1750, and there's a little bit of the score. Later on, I guess in the late 60s, there was an edition made by a woman called Ethel Thurston on Kalmus edition, The Complete Works of Perrotin, which is a very slim volume in modern notation. And I went over that quite a bit. Now, jumping to what I did, what did it influence? Well, four organs that I alluded to earlier as a piece that caused a scandal. Four organs is basically, can be described as short chord gets long, very long. It goes from 11 beats to 256 beats. And it is basically elongating the various notes within the chord, so that kind of, you can imagine it as a kind of bar graph, from horizontal bar graph going out from left to right further and further, with each note having its own trajectory. I would never have written that piece, which is basically my take on extreme augmentation, had I not heard the Parisian. So, and that technique of augmentation also is heard in simpler form, actually, in music for mallets and for voices and organ, and in music for 18 musicians, and in many other pieces. So, Parisian is something that I really, I think one of the things that you can, that I feel very strongly is, you learn most in the music you love. If you're obliged to study something, you can do that, and you will learn something, but it probably will not have the potency of learning something from a piece of music that you really love. And Parisian was something that I really loved.
It didn't. I understand that his work had an influence, maybe a more specific influence on a piece of yours called Proverb.
Yes, very good. Thank you. Yeah, I passed that by. Well, I mean, I was sticking with the early pieces. Paul Hillier, who's a singer and conductor, who is very associated with Arvo Pärt, is a great conductor I admire enormously. Wanted me to write a piece for him, and it ended up being a piece called Proverb, where the text came from Ludwig Wittgenstein, who is the philosopher I studied when I was at Cornell, which is basically how small a thought it takes to fill a whole life. As you point out, the subtext there was really an homage to Parrott, and the whole piece was kind of an homage to Parrott. I had his Bitter and Omnes, one of the two four-part organ in the big pieces, on the piano as I was writing the piece. I personally think it's one of the best pieces I ever did. It's not that long. I think it's a little under 15 minutes. And there's a recording on None Such which was made by Paul Hillier. And so it's something that you can hear. And it is definitely unthinkable without Parisian, because it uses canons which don't appear in Parisian, but they're augmentation canons, so that the whole thing goes from something that you hear as melodic to something that you hear as kind of a held harmony, constantly changing inner notes.
You know, one of the things that I find interesting, and I've had a number of conversations recently about early music, and I'm struck by the fact that it seems to be still almost the secret fraternity, you know, with a handshake, and you know, there's it's well known, or at least, you know, people know that it exists, early music, but it seems really kind of underappreciated, and I wonder if that's because it's so different sounding now than what people are used to thinking of as music, or just because people haven't heard it, or what?
Well, I can't judge, but Nico Muhly is someone I've gotten very close with, and he's devoted to early music and has done some very detailed work on William Byrd's music and other people a little bit later, more in the Renaissance. I think that starting in the 20th century, which now feels a little while ago, I guess more in the later 20th century, a lot of composers began taking a very hard second look at medieval Renaissance music. And what you find there is, in terms of composition, very specific techniques. I mentioned the augmentation, taking something that is so many beats long and then elongating, and in the case of Parisian, vast increases of unmeasurable. We don't know what his, you know, how many quarter, there weren't any quarter notes or half notes in his time, so exactly how that was done, there's no system that we can observe. Then the basic structure of canon, which goes back, I think, 13th century, was the first that we know of. And canon is the backbone of what I've done. I sort of picked it up by playing through Bartók's Mikrokosmos, the very first books. It sort of predated Bartók by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So some very essential basic techniques, without canon you don't have fugue, get born in the medieval period, and they're very very useful structurally, because the idea of what is the canon? Well, you know, what does it sound like? I have no idea what it sounds like. What it is, a sound, some sound, could be somebody speaking, could be my friend James Tenney, who's no longer with us, did a canon on a glissando. which I call the barber pole piece, and somebody else called Busy Day at JFK. It is a canon. It sounds, you know, like some kind of very strange piece of electronic music. But it's an idea where a sound is followed by itself at an unspecified rhythmic distance. And that's wide open to be filled with any sound that you, in the 20th century, 21st century, and on to the future, want to fill it up with. And that's the durability of these ideas, is that they're empty vessels to be filled with whatever personal material you want to put into them.
The final song chosen by Reich was John Coltrane's Africa from the album Africa Brass.
Africa Brass by John Coltrane is an absolutely amazing piece, amazing recording. It dates from 1961, 4 years before NC, well before anything that is now called minimal music was heard. And what is striking about Africa Brass is that basically it's all built for 16, 17 minutes on E, specifically the low E of the double bass, played by Jimmy Garrison on the recording. So if you were asking, I heard about Africa Brass, man, what's the changes, meaning what are the chord changes? What change? E for 16, 17 minutes. Well, with that in mind, let's say in 1961, you might think, oh, come on, give me a break. You know, how can that, anything that stays on E for 16, 17 minutes be of interest? Well, how does it work? Number one, you've got Coltrane himself, who's playing soprano saxophone and sometimes playing these beautiful melodic, beautiful melodies. And other times, just screaming noise through the instrument. So you've got a great deal of melodic variety. You've got Eric Dolphy, a wonderful musician, wonderful jazz musician, usually an alto sax player, but also a brilliant orchestrator, who was writing out the brass parts in Africa Brass and wrote a lot of French horn glissandos, which kind of sound like whoop, 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 like elephants coming through the jungle. So you've got timbral variety, a really wild timbral variety going on there. And then you've got Elvin Jones, who's like two or three drummers put into one. He's the most polyrhythmic drummer in the history of jazz. And so if you have that rhythmic energy and vitality and irregularity, and the melodic invention, and timbre of writing, hey, 16 minutes on E is not even enough. And the constancy of the harmony makes an intensity. Now, how did it affect me at the time? It was just kind of like a wonderful thing, which, along with African drumming, specifically Ghanaian drumming, and Balinese gamelan, both of which I studied by playing them, went into forming what I eventually did. But specifically, I have often thought back, and at the time I wasn't thinking about it, to drumming. Drumming is my piece in 1971. 10 years after Africa Brass, and I certainly wasn't thinking about Africa Brass when I wrote it. But it's in six sharps for an hour, and I mean, there's one small modulation during the glockenspiel section, but it's hardly what keeps the piece going. So you've got constant harmony. You've got a lot of rhythmic complexity in drumming, that's for sure. And the little rhythmic complexity is tied to these interlocking melodic patterns played on the first on the tune drums, and then the marimbas, and then the glockenspiels. So later I thought to myself, my gosh, you know, it's the same kind of ingredients to make the piece work, totally different piece. And I wasn't even thinking about it. But again, as we mentioned earlier with the Stravinsky bubbling up in my head, you know, while I'm writing Tahalim, things happen on an unconscious level that are caused by music that you've heard, but you're not necessarily thinking about it at the time.
Do you recall when and where you heard it?
Oh, it was a recording, and I don't really it was in San Francisco. I was in the Bernal Heights neighborhood in San Francisco, and I was there from 61 through 65, getting ready to go to graduate school at Mills College and study with Luciano Berio, and hear John Coltrane live many, many, many times at the Jazz Workshop.
Did you get to see enough shows that you sort of got to watch that progression in his music from more sort of, you know, what people used to call inside to, you know, more out?
Well, I don't know exactly what they mean by that, but I mean, I saw him play notably with Eric Dolphy, and I heard him play, you know, My Favorite Things, of course, and music of that day. Africa Brass was never done by the quartet. I mean, wisely. I mean, it was a recording phenomenon. It was a piece of music which was for which you needed a large brass section. So that was never played. And in most of the pieces I heard of his, there were some chords, very often just two chords. Yes, it made a big impression, but no, there was no recreation of African Brass.
This has been Essential Tremors. Essential Tremors is produced by me, Matt Byers, and Lee Gardner. Essential Tremors is distributed by WYPR Baltimore and NPR. Look for and subscribe to all of WYPR's podcasts at wypr.org/podcastcentral. For more information about Essential Tremors, go to essentialpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.